and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the results of the elections for the European Parliament, in which the much-feared rise of the far-right seizing enough seats to paralyse the EU did not materialise, and instead there were gains on the left, with the Greens winning 69 seats in the European Parliament, up from 52 seats in 2014. Daniela Schwarzer, who is the director of the German Council on Foreign Relations, joins us to discuss the EU elections, which saw the highest turnout in two decades, and analyse the results that indicate the long-serving centre-right and centre-left coalitions have lost their majorities to gains on the populist right and the environmentalist left. Gains by Salvini's far-right anti-immigrant league in Italy, the far-right nationalist rally of Marine Le Pen's in France, and the UK's new Brexit Party were to some extent offset by the collapse of Austria's governing right-wing coalition, not to mention the strongest ever results for Germany's Greens, who took 21% of the vote, just behind Chancellor Merkel's Christian Democrats. In a CNN interview, Merkel warned that there is work to be done in Germany to confront dark forces on the rise in Europe, and she strongly rejected ceding any ground to populist parties. Instead, she spoke of a need to show, quote, why we are a democracy, why we try to bring about solutions, why we always have to put ourselves in the other person's shoes, why we must stand up against intolerance, why we show no tolerance towards violations of human rights. Then we'll get an assessment of Trump's just-concluded state visit to Japan, which prioritized pomp over policy, where at the closing press conference, in one breath, Trump undercut his national security adviser and Japan's Prime Minister Abe by suggesting North Korea's recent short-range missile tests were not a big deal and did not violate UN sanctions, which they did. Apparently, Trump is only concerned about North Korea's long-range missiles, which could reach the United States. But for Japan, Kim Jong-un's nuclear-tipped short-range missiles are a big deal. Kent Harrington, a former senior CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia, joins us to discuss his article at Project Syndicate, Kim Jong-un's Moneyball Strategy and Trump's Japan Trip. Then finally, we look into whether the Democrats will embrace working-class politics in the 2020 campaign or play more towards identity politics and social issues, as few candidates in the crowded field rely on union support, while most hew towards issues which concern donors that do not necessarily resonate with working Americans. Eric Blanc, a former high school teacher who writes on labor movements past and present for The Guardian and The Nation, joins us to discuss his new book, Red State Revolt, The Teachers' Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Daniela Schwarzer, who is the director of the German Council on Foreign Relations, who previously was research director on the board of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Her research focuses on German and European foreign policy, European institutions, political and economic affairs of the EU, and transatlantic relations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniela Schwarzer.
Hello.
Well, thank you for joining us. So tell me, it looks as though the kind of dark prince of American politics, Stephen Bannon, didn't have a very good day yesterday or the last few days with the European election results. We were under the impression that he'd been working with Salvini in Italy and trying to organize all of these far-right parties across Europe and particularly, of course, Western Europe. And there was a fear that they would get to a point where they'd have veto power over the agenda of the EU, but that does not appear to have happened. So I imagine a lot of people are breathing a sigh of relief.
Indeed. If you look at the numbers across the EU, there are reasons to be relieved because, indeed, there is a very strong political center. If you take together the Conservatives, the Social Democrats, the Greens, and the Liberals. And so the far right and the very far left, they can't create any blocking minority in the European Parliament. However, if you look at individual countries, for instance, take Italy, the far-right party Lega came first, and also in other countries they scored particularly high. Germany is an example where the expectations were far worse than the results. So I can tell you in Berlin there were signs of relief on Sunday night.
And, of course, across Europe, there were more voters turning out, the highest turnout in two decades, with about 50% of European voters showing up at the polls. That in itself, though, indicates that these elections have never been particularly popular.
Indeed, the participation in the European elections has been going down every 5 years for a number of decades now. So the 2019 elections stand out as a good example. So more people went to the polls, and the reason for that is, in my view, first of all, very ambitious mobilization campaigns in some countries where civil society actors, political parties, even companies actually told their staff to go and vote, whatever they vote, but just go out and vote. And the other reason was really the fear that anti-European parties may actually score high and hence paralyze the system from within. And if you compare this to public opinion, it's really interesting to see that even in those countries where people have elected EU critical parties into government, the population generally still sees advantages in being part of the EU. That is true, for instance, for Poland, where a very critical party forms the government. However, the Poles firmly believe that it's in their interest to be part of the EU.
So the centre-left and the centre-right coalition, nevertheless, were holding 54% of the seats in the European Parliament. That is the group known as the European People's Party on the centre-right and the centre-left Progressive Alliance of Socialists and Democrats. So they're down from 54% now to 43%. What does it mean, though, right across the board here, not just in Europe, but here in the United States? We have Donald Trump moving the Republican Party to the right and Bernie Sanders moving the Democratic Party to the left. What's happening with these traditional center-right and center-left parties?
In a number of EU countries and also on the EU level, the mainstream parties have lost voters for a number of years now. And so what is now happening in the European Parliament, namely that the two traditionally largest parties can't form a grand coalition anymore, that basically mirrors what has been happening on the national level for a while. For the European Parliament, this will be actually quite interesting because, the coalition that could get a majority, if it is a stable coalition, has to be formed of at least three parties. But the way the European Parliament works, in my view, makes it much more likely that we will see coalitions of parties on certain issues. For instance, if you take the climate change agenda that the Greens push very strongly, and they scored high in those elections compared to former years, they will definitely try and get other parties on board for this issue and campaign very vocally in the European Parliament. And that's just one example to say that I believe we are leaving the times when there was one large, stable coalition, but we will move towards a more political parliament where parties take the lead on certain issues and they form the majorities or try and form the majorities according to the topics on the agenda.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniela Schwarzer, who's in Germany. She's the director of the German Council on Foreign Relations and previously was research director on the board of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. And her research focuses on German and European foreign policy, European institutions, political and economic affairs of the EU and transatlantic relations. But you didn't mention polarization, which is pretty much the headlines here in the United States about the European elections. Do you see this as a trend towards polarization, which we certainly have here in this country?
Yes, this is happening in Europe as well. And interestingly, it is happening between parties, just as you described for the United States, that parties move further to the right and further to the left. That's happening in Europe as well. However, when we look at the European Parliament, I guess what we will see is also polarization within parliamentary groups. Because the way these parliamentary groups are composed is basically bringing together MPs from very many EU countries, and they may come from very different political cultures. And as politics is becoming more volatile, more polarized, far quicker and more, let's say, more outspoken and more radical in some positions, this will also impact the work of the European Parliament.
So with the Greens getting 21% of the vote in Germany ahead of Chancellor Merkel's Christian Democrats, you're mentioning that that's, in many ways, it may be the subtext here might well be global warming, which I imagine is also something that concerns the Netherlands, since much of that country is below sea level, etc. So that's energizing the left, if you will. What's energizing the right, short of what we normally understand as unemployment, security, terrorism, and tensions over migration?
Well, I guess the right, so the moderate right, obviously is very interested in economic policy and competitiveness, where Europe has big questions to tackle. How do we further develop the Eurozone? How do we develop the single market? How do we step up our competitiveness vis-a-vis China? And how do we deal with the United States, with a U.S. president that is increasingly challenging to Europeans? Then if you move further to the right, if you look at the far right, they have clearly campaigned on migration issues and identity issues, basically picking up the fears that people have, socioeconomic fears, but also fears for their national identities and regional identities. But what showed in these elections is that they overestimated their potential, and polls generally overestimated them as well, because voters at the end of the day weren't that attracted by those messages of fear. And that's probably one of the reasons why they scored less well than was anticipated.
And do you think that what happened in Austria had an effect where the vice chancellor was caught in a video sting, which I believe originated out of Der Spiegel in Germany? And of course, his chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, he just lost a no confidence vote on Sunday, so his government's collapsed. Was that a factor, do you think?
It was widely debated throughout the European Union. And of course, the question that came up was whether Russian influence plays in, or to what extent Russian influence plays in other far-right parties. However, if you look at the effect of this in Austria, the government collapsed, but the voters of that particular party were pretty stable. So it didn't have an immediate electoral effect on the voters, but on the obviously on the political leaders of the party and on Kurz, who headed the government.
Well, but of course, the sting was essentially a Russian woman. Actually, she turned out to be Latvian, but she was pretending to be the niece of a Russian oligarch, and she was, literally had the vice chancellor of Austria, head of the Freedom Party, which was founded by ex-Nazis, essentially selling out his country for money. And what is the reasoning or the attraction that people like the vice chancellor, the former vice chancellor of Austria, Strache, and also people like Orban, who did well in these elections, by the way, his party Fidesz in Hungary did well. Has anybody ever figured this out? For the life of me, I don't know why these Western European countries or former East countries like Hungary have this romance with Putin. Do you have a kind of handle on it, Daniela?
Well, Putin is a political character. It's a kind of a strong man who likes to, you know, show up with other strong men. And Orban, for instance, has used this image frequently to basically say that, you know, he is someone that whom the Russian president takes seriously. Interestingly, Hungary, among other Central and Eastern European states, really stands out because it doesn't take a critical stance on Russia and doesn't have fears about Russian destabilization, security fears that you would, for instance, find in Poland or in the Baltic countries. So I guess Russian influence already also plays out in those countries. There are many stories about financial ties, about corruption and other incidences. And so I think the Russian influence really at this point also, you know, goes into the deeper tissue of the country. But this, as I said, is really not a general phenomenon in Central and Eastern Europe, but quite the contrary. A lot of Central and Eastern Europeans are very engaged in countering Russian disinformation campaigns, in highlighting attempts of Russians to influence national debates or even to meddle in, elections. And so there is a clear split within the European Union. And what obviously Russians tried to, establish before the European elections took place were close ties with far-right parties in, a number of EU countries. But as we saw with the electoral results, this didn't bring the success that many had feared.
Well, of course, the outgoing Vice Chancellor of Austria's party, the Freedom Party, Strache's party, they had an, a formal alliance with Putin's United Russia, as did Salvini's party in Italy. Le Pen took a lot of money from a Russian state-owned bank. And we know that in the UK, this character, Aaron Banks, who was married to a woman that turned out to be an FSB prostitute who was kicked out of the Emirates and ended up marrying him. And he put up £9 million, the biggest donor, into the Leave campaign that brought about Brexit. It's not difficult to see the Russia's fingerprints on that one. And, you have to admit that for a £9 million investment, the UK has been paralyzed for months and years, I guess. And, they're still paralyzed. It's an extraordinary phenomenon, wouldn't you say?
The UK is indeed politically paralyzed, and I would even go as far as saying it is in a political crisis. However, I wouldn't say all of this is because of Russian influence. Clearly, Russian influence has been traced, but I think the UK is going into a, through a far more complex period of actually figuring out what kind of sovereignty and independence it, thinks it can have on its own, and what why it would need the European Union, and whether leaving the EU at this point looks like a promising thing to do. And I think over the past month it has clearly turned out how costly this step is, and that is actually discredited in the eyes of many, not only Brits but also Europeans, the narrative of those who promise a much brighter future without the European Union.
But for some reason or other, they still can't get enough votes to do a do-over, a second referendum, which all analysts say would go the opposite way, that this time Remain would win over Leave. So to that extent, the paralysis continues.
That is very true. At this point in time, the British Parliament hasn't been able to forge a majority on any of the options that are currently on the table. So neither on the negotiated deal, nor on a Brexit without a deal, nor on a second referendum. And that is really where the paralysis comes from. Not only Parliament, but also the British public is so split over those options. And there are some who actually forecast that if the UK goes to a second referendum, this would be seen as so undemocratic by those who voted Leave in the first referendum that there could be actually something like, civil unrest, definitely protests, and an even more complicated political situation, because if you then hold that second referendum, you get a majority for Remain, but you cannot get this accepted within society and then have a parliament who doesn't really support this. The mess could be even bigger. That's why some say it would be a mistake to do so. However, there needs to be some moment of clarification for the UK. And, you know, first of all, the government tried to bring this clarification through its negotiations with the other Europeans. It had a deal done, but it wasn't able to get parliamentary approval. Then this whole process was seized by Westminster, by the British Parliament. And now we are in a situation where Parliament has not been able to agree on anything. Now there will be a change of Prime Minister, but that won't definitely, in my view, will not clarify the situation.
Well, Daniela Schwarzer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniela Schwarzer, who is the director of the German Council on Foreign Relations, who previously was research director on the board of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Her research focuses on German and European foreign policy, European institutions, political and economic affairs of the EU, and transatlantic relations. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an assessment of Trump's just concluded state visit to Japan. Whoa!
organize, you're bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists bound to lose.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kent Harrington. He's a former senior CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia. And he has an article at Project Syndicate, Kim Jong-un's Moneyball Strategy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kent Harrington.
Thanks, Ian. Good to talk with you.
Well, thank you, Kent. And Kim Jong-un got quite a boost from Donald Trump, who praised him in front at the press conference with Prime Minister Abe in Japan on the state visit. And clearly it made Abe uncomfortable. And Trump said that the North Korean recently firing off these missiles was no big deal, which is something that Abe certainly disagreed with. But he also took the opportunity to attack Joe Biden. And say that he agreed with Kim Jong-un's analysis of Joe Biden, which is pretty extraordinary. So I don't quite know where to start. Do you want to tell us about what you mean by Kim Jong-un's Moneyball strategy first?
Well, it's really quite astonishing that we're talking about of presidential behavior that is almost in every instance utterly ignoring, even turning on its head, precedents that go back even several hundred years. There's no easy place to pick out as a low point of this particular visit because there are so many. The one thing I would say is the beneficiary of most of what happened in Tokyo at this point is none other than Kim Jong-un and his North Korean strategy, which is dramatically different than the flying by the seat of the pants approach that Trump is obviously taking, is worth looking at, in my view, simply because the contrast is also accompanied by a set of results that I think are moving Kim into a much more influential position in being able to shape these negotiations. You may remember a movie a few years ago that chronicled the story of Billy Beane, the fabled manager of the Oakland Athletics that took them to the longest winning streak in baseball history, all by virtue of a strategy that avoided, because he couldn't afford it, trying to compete and hire high paid talent that could whack home runs and concentrating on baseball players who could consistently get on base and score runs for the A's. The Moneyball strategy was one that was devised in order to deal with the reality that the Oakland A's faced. They were a small market team, and for that reason, they didn't have big budgets for high-priced talent. Well, if you draw a parallel with Kim Jong-un and you start looking at what he's been doing, both to cultivate Trump in a very, I think, effective way, playing to his ego, but also in opening doors that have not quite been opened in the way Kim has done with respect to China and Russia, two traditional but often very distant allies for North Korea. You see a version of Moneyball that Kim is playing. He doesn't have deep pockets, but he's pretty clever. Lining up on his side, the two most important allies, North Korea Korea has had in all of its existence, and beginning, I think, to coordinate strategy with them in ways that's going to advantage Kim as the North Korean relationship with Trump and as the issue of North Korea's nuclear program goes forward. Specifically, I think he's got a division of labor with the Chinese taking his side in ways that are going to be influential in arguing that sanctions need to be eased, in part because it's the only way that North Korea is going to begin to cooperate in the manner the United States wants. And second, in bringing Vladimir Putin to the table, who is clearly saying that it's time that both China and Russia are part of the negotiations. If they come to the table, obviously there's only one side of the table they're going to sit on. So I would look at these developments, to be sure, as a continuation of the relationship between Kim and his country's two principal allies. But I would also look on them as a reshaping of that relationship that's going to make it harder and harder for Trump, all of his bombast and tweeted threats notwithstanding, to move the talks that he claims have already made great progress, and that's certainly a dubious proposition, in the direction that any United States official or any president would want them to go.
And again, I'm speaking with Kent Harrington, who's a former senior CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia, and he has an article at Project Syndicate, Kim Jong-un's Moneyball Strategy. Well, it would seem, though, that the sanctions are fraying, and I can't see why the Chinese would want to stick with the sanctions, or the Russians for that matter, where there's a lot of covert sanction busting going on, although not a lot of trade with Russia, but an enormous amount with China. So if the Trump administration's basically ginning up a trade war against China and going after Huawei, which is the country's, China's sort of premier corporation, not that there's not good reasons to be concerned that a company that's, whose founder was a was and probably still is a member of the colonel in the People's Liberation Army. Nevertheless, I can't see the incentive on the part of the Chinese and the Russians to cooperate with Trump. Can you?
Well, I think you're touching on a very important point, and I think the very mix of issues that you've just described in raising this question have to be the ones that the Chinese are weighing as they do a kind of matrix, if you will, on their whiteboards and figure out, politically speaking, which areas they plan to cooperate in and which ones they plan to use as leverage. The interests of the Chinese and the Russians, of course, are on the same page as are our interests in one major way. No one wants to see a war on the Korean Peninsula or tensions rise to the point where the risks of a war become, if you will, unmanageable. But at the same time, there's, as you suggest, a real question as to what are the incentives for the Chinese and the Russians to cooperate. The fact that we're pressing the Chinese in a whole host of areas, most of which, by the way, are legitimate issues for any American administration to press on, but are doing it in a fashion that is virtually uncoordinated, a fashion that's almost scattershot, if not scatterbrained, is opening a door to the Chinese to be manipulative on their part in picking and choosing what they plan to respond to. There's real pressures operating on Xi Jinping and his party leadership at the top, but at the same time, there are opportunities for them to push back. With respect to whether or not they'll cooperate with North Korea, there's another dimension to this issue, which the Trump administration, I think, frankly, is totally ignoring, at least in terms of its public behavior. I'm sure people are thinking about this behind the scenes who are expert on the area. And that is the fact that neither China nor Russia share our interest in eliminating Kim's nuclear program, which isn't to say they support Kim having an independent nuclear force, but the fact is Kim has one, and how effective it is may be an issue, but his possession of nuclear weapons and his status as a nuclear state aren't in question. The stability of the regime is something that's extraordinarily important to both China and Russia. So they aren't in a position, as they look at their own strategic interests, to do things that are going to push Kim in a way that could destabilize him. That is, to push with the same degree of vigor that Trump does with some of his rhetoric when he's not playing footsie rhetorically with Kim, seeking the North's total abandonment of the program up front. They want to see a North Korea that remains in the hands of people who are their allies, because that's the security that they need on their borders. Not a unified Korea under a South Korean U.S. ally that could even entail American troops that are on the Yalu River down the road, so to speak. So it's really important that we look at the matrix of issues that the Trump administration has raised and ask the question, just as you were, are they moving forward on all these fronts, or are they basically getting all tangled up in their own underwear, as I think is more the case, as they try to use sanctions on multiple issues and link implicitly or explicitly trade with Korea, Huawei with trade, going on and on. It's not a wise approach.
So, Kent Harrington, when you mentioned the stability of North Korea, of the regime, is something that concerns the Chinese and the Russians, since they are neighbors of North Korea. I'm hearing reports, and I'd be interested to see whether you've been hearing similar reports, that obviously it's a very opaque regime, and it's hard to find out what's happening there, and it's been on the brink of collapse for some time. But my understanding is that things are extremely bad now, with droughts, food shortages, which are not uncommon. But there's also an epidemic of drug-resistant tuberculosis as well. What are you hearing about the stability of the regime itself in terms of you know, it being a failed state with nuclear weapons?
Well, I think everything you've described has been a factor in North Korea's economy and in the suffering, as there's no other way to put it, of North Koreans outside the elite and the technocratic as well as political elites that are in Pyongyang and whatever other cities are favored. The vast majority of North Koreans have been struggling with everything you've described. Health issues, public health is abysmal in North Korea. Food shortages, as you suggest, that have been persistent and have turned to the point of crises on more than one occasion. And 2019 may be a very difficult year with North Korea because of a combination of weather and economic problems. Issues having to do with access to just day-to-day provisioning that have led the North Korean leadership, Kim in particular, to accept and adopt a much more flexible approach to the marketplace in North Korea in order to give people the opportunity to barter, trade, buy, sell, in order to just simply sustain themselves. So when you start looking item by item, take public health, drug-resistant tuberculosis, and the prospect for epidemic, these are things that the North Koreans have never had a good handle on because of the way in which the regime has essentially devoted the vast majority of the resources it had access to the military and to military technology development programs, and to sustaining the elite rather than to investing in the country's broad population and their needs. When it comes to North Korea and its ability to feed itself, clearly the North is again going to be turning to the international community, and that is just a systemic problem that they have as a result of the poverty of the country over several generations that's produced an agricultural system that is not only rudimentary in terms of the way in which it's managed and technologically exploited or developed, but it also simply isn't filling the bill and delivering what North Koreans need to survive. These are issues that are going to come out of the well-being of the vast majority of North Koreans, but I would stop short of looking at them as issues as destabilizing as one might believe they would be in any other system. Kim's major investment has been in ensuring the Kim dynasty's control and its ability to maintain a highly coercive security service and intelligence and internal security system. And I think that is going to be the buffer, as it has been for generations, frankly, three generations of Kims, that protect the elite from the kind of problems that we're talking about today.
So back to Japan, where there was just a recently concluded state visit by Donald Trump. And I mentioned the press conference where Trump praised Kim Jong-un, which obviously made Prime Minister Abe of Japan very uncomfortable. There was an earlier sumo match that he attended and a banquet with the new emperor and empress. The empress, of course, being a fairly impressive woman, speaks several languages, etc. What was your sense on our bull in the China shop conducting diplomacy?
Well, I have to admit, I give Abe a very high marks for the way in which he pulled this off, but he also has my sympathies. I can only imagine the sigh of relief that he breathed. All of the differences that were aired with respect to both North Korean trade, notwithstanding, when he saw wheels go up on Air Force One. The fact of the matter is, as your description of the state visit suggests, this was clearly an effort to prioritize pomp and circumstance over policy. That there were discussions behind the scenes with Trump, no question about that. But if you start thinking about Abe's role here, Abe is in the sixth or I've lost track now year of his tenure, perhaps the seventh. He's one of the longest serving, soon to be the longest serving prime minister, if he lasts through 2020, that Japan has had. His role has been to move Japan in directions that, from a conservative point of view, and I use that term conservative small c, the LDP is a conservative party, achieve some of the objectives of the base, so to speak, that Abe reflects and has come from, which is to say an effort to rebuild Japan or continue to build Japan's military capabilities, to create options for Japan in terms of relationships in Asia, elsewhere in the world, such as in Europe, that will not necessarily undermine the U.S. relationship, but will give Japan choices down the road, and to manage effectively a U.S. relationship, which provides an enormous benefit to Japan in terms of a security guarantee as well as a marketplace. The visit, Trump's behavior, I think, doesn't appear to have violated all that many norms of sort of standard human relationships and social discourse, but it was one that really, I think, reflected the choreography and theatrics combined that show that Abe has learned his role very, very well in the time he's been in office and learned to manage Trump very well. Two things I would mention very quickly are, first, that the North Korean perspective that he reflected in the press conference is deeply felt. The last things the Japanese want is to be left out of a deal with North Korea, because their fear is quite simply that Trump will leave them hanging with respect to North Korean capabilities to use force in the region that can directly threaten Japan, but may meet American, i.e. Trump's, desire to create some sort of agreement on intercontinental ballistic missiles, but not those that are shorter range. In other words, the North Korean threat is real for Japan in ways that it is not for the U.S. Second, Abe is looking at the trade issue much as the Europeans are, and saying to himself, what do I need to do to make this go away? That's a huge problem for a Japan whose growth has had its fits and starts. And Abe's great success a few years ago in bringing an uptick in Japanese growth is much like the situation she faces, one that will not necessarily endure if there are major trade differences with the United States. It's already been on kind of rocky ground. So I would watch this space, as they say, both the Korean issue and the trade issue, because clearly those are ones that Abe is going to have a harder time managing than the pomp and circumstance of the last 4 days.
Well, Kent Harrington, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure, Ian. Good to talk to you once more.
Well, thanks again, and I've been speaking with Kent Harrington, who's a former senior CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia, and he has an article of Project Syndicate, Kim Jong-un's Moneyball Strategy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the Democrats will embrace working-class politics in the 2020 campaign. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Blanc, who is a former high school teacher in the Bay Area, who writes on labor movements past and present for The Guardian and The Nation, and is the author of the new book just out, Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Blanc.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you, Eric. And just to start with working class politics, that seems to be the sort of split, if you will, in the Democratic field running for president between those advocating working class politics and those wanting to hew to the center like Joe Biden. What's your sense of how that, I hesitate to call it a battle, let's call it a debate to be polite, but where do you think that's heading?
Well, it's hard to know where it's heading, but what's clear is that the Democratic Party establishment remains fully committed to fielding a pro-corporate candidate, even if it means making their party less likely to win in the election. That was clear in 2016 with the maneuvers to get Bernie marginalized, and it's evident that they're trying to do the same thing this time, both with Bernie and to a lesser extent with Elizabeth Warren. So the stakes are quite high, whether it's in terms of winning things like Medicare for All or public education or just plain old defeating Trump. It seems like the Democratic Party leadership is still committed to a strategy that's born to lose, if you will.
But on the Republican side, Trump and company and his campaign want to run against a socialist. They can't wait for Bernie to win. So what does that tell you?
Well, it's hard to say. I think that the reality is that the ruling class and its various fractions are very divided right now, and it's not clear to anybody up on top how best to steer the ship and how best to neutralize what is really a political insurgency, whether it's the strikes or the Bernie Sanders campaign. So I think it's really going to be up to people to organize from below. It's not at all clear what is going to be best for the Republicans or the Democratic Party establishments.
Well, to that extent, Bernie Sanders did very well with his town hall on Fox. It's interesting that there seems to be a receptive audience on the right in this country for example, Medicare for All.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that Trump pushed back even against Fox News for what he saw as not wrongly providing a platform for Bernie to undercut some of his appeal amongst working class voters. And the reality is people are looking for an alternative to the status quo. And as you mentioned, there really is a thirst amongst a wide variety of voters and people generally for what is something that looks different than the same politics as usual. And I do think that Bernie in particular, because he's able to speak to the kind of anti-establishment sentiment that is widespread and that bizarrely, which Trump was able to somehow attract as well, Bernie really, I do think, is the best contender to shave off some of that working class resentment in the direction of progressive politics.
Well, apparently the town hall that Bernie Sanders did on Fox News back in April essentially ended up with more than half of the audience supporting, a majority supporting Medicare for All.
Yeah, it was my favorite moment of the political season so far is when they asked who in the audience was in favor of Medicare for All, assuming presumably that it would be stone cold silence. I felt like almost the majority of the people or the vast majority raised their hands. So it's a sign of the times where really there is a big pushback in quarters you might not normally expect it.
So this has got to have the establishment suffering from heartburn, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they really are at a loss to figure out how to neutralize this insurgency, because whether it's the teacher strikes or the Bernie Sanders campaign, attacking it just isn't seeming to work. So when they try to attack the teachers, it's a hard sell because the overwhelming public opinion is in favor of the teacher strikes and their demands. But it's the same when they try to attack Bernie. They're actually feeding the narrative, which is accurate, that the billionaire class wants to defeat an anti-establishment candidate. And so if you read their insider insider reports, they've been actually kind of reluctant to go full throttle in the worry that it will actually backfire on them and it'll make it clear who their real corporate funders and backers are. So it's an exciting time because normally we're the people who are sort of at a loss at how to proceed. So it's nice to see a little bit of discomfort at least up above.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Blanc, who is a former high school teacher in the Bay Area who writes on labor movements past and present for The Guardian and The Nation, and is the author of the new book just out, Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. So let's talk about the subject of your book, these red state revolts, these teacher strikes starting in West Virginia and going to Kansas and other red states. It was an extraordinary phenomenon, and it's particularly important to recognize that these revolts by teachers' unions, where they literally took over state legislatures, happened in states that have very anti-union laws and public employees, unions, members aren't allowed to strike, etc. So there again, that must have been quite a wake-up for the kind of right-wing establishment.
Yeah, and I think it's a wake-up also for the liberal establishment, because what the strike showed was the extreme superficiality of this blue state, red state narrative, which is so predominant, right? According to the mainstream media, most of the states in between the coasts are these deep red bastions of conservatism and deep racism amongst all working people and the white working class as a whole. And, you know, if that were true, it's very hard to explain what just happened, in which you had a large number of workers of all ethnic backgrounds going on strike against Republican legislators. And, you know, frankly, a lot of the teachers that went on strike had voted for Trump, and they had voted for Trump, you know, overwhelmingly not for racist reasons per se, but because they were sick of the status quo, didn't like Hillary Clinton, and it seemed like something different. And what we saw in the teacher strikes was this latent anger and this latent desire for really systematic shifting of priorities, particularly around education. But the implications of what they did were really widespread and quite deep, because in order to win more funding for education, in order to win better funding for teacher pay, they had to take on the corporations that have been, you know, basically bleeding the coffers of these states. So it wasn't just a fight against Republicans, but against the big corporations that have been really systematically taking the profits off of working people in these states for decades now.
So you went to West Virginia, Eric Blanc, to cover the teacher strike for Jacobin. And they won in spite of the fact that the state house is controlled by Republicans and they have a coal baron as governor. How did they do it? I know it's a subject of your book, but give us a shorthand version.
Yeah, well, the short version is strikes are very powerful. The strike as a weapon is really the type of tactic that working people can be most effective in wielding, because if you don't go to work, if you work either in public sector or in the private sector, you create a crisis for those who rule the society. And that is a tremendous amount of leverage that unfortunately hasn't been tapped for a long time, because unions have been overwhelmingly focused just on lobbying the Democratic Party. And so the normal thinking about how you make change was shown to be quite superficial at best, because the idea is normally, well, if you have Republicans in the legislature, you're not going to be able to win anything. So first you're going to have to win the Democrats, put them into power, and only after that could you conceive of winning significant demands. But what this showed was actually in all of these red states, by creating a mass movement, by winning the public support, they were able to force the politicians and Republicans in particular to meet their demands, because they didn't go to work, and the overwhelming number of parents and the public at large supported them, and the Republicans were forced to cave eventually.
Well, there was a very interesting town hall recently on CNN that Chris Matthews held in Pennsylvania. And as you know, Pennsylvania is a key swing state, and Trump has campaigned there quite a lot. And Biden, it is assumed, because he was born in Pennsylvania, will be a significant threat to Trump, who needs those Rust Belt states to eke out another win if he is to have one in 2020. But there was a working class guy. He was a union guy. I think he said he was with the Electrical Union. I'm not sure what union it was, but he says he's a proud union guy. He just said, you know, my whole family, my grandfather, going back to his grandparents, are all union people. I've always voted Democrat. And he addressed this directly to the head of the Democratic Party that was there, the head of the DNC, and said, you know, what is happening to the Democratic Party? He said, all you care about are these social issues. You don't care about us. You don't care about us working people. And as far as I'm concerned, my family, my job, my life, my health care, my pension is a social issue for me. So why don't you care about that? And I thought to myself, my God, you know, that really is a – if ever there was a wake-up call for the Democrats, I think that was it.
Yeah, the reality is the Democratic Party for decades now has married an anti-working class, pro-austerity politics to a sort of social liberalism that is good on – or better at least than the Republicans on issues of equality – racism, sexism, things like that. But it's actually quite dangerous if you think about it, as your anecdote shows, which is by tying a policy really which hurts people's material interests across the board, not just white workers, but all working people, and tying that type of politics at the same time to a sort of liberal identity politics, it makes it actually harder amongst large numbers of working people for us to win people to anti-racist politics. You know, we need to be able to make it clear that it's not because of the immigrants, it's not because of women that you're losing your job, but it's actually because of the billionaires. But insofar as the Democratic Party has combined these two messages, it's really made it hard to make that case to people. So we need to disaggregate them. And again, to bring it back to Bernie, Bernie's made it clear. He's fighting for the material interest, Medicare for all, better pay. But he's also taken the right position on equal rights for immigrants, the women's right to choose. And that can be a very compelling narrative when you combine those issues rather than actually marrying corporate politics to liberalism.
Well, to some extent, the issues came up on Saturday at the anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. Bernie Sanders made a speech in South Carolina outlining a plan to put a halt to charter school funding. And that had been met with a lot of criticism from centrist commentators who are trying to tie Bernie Sanders' position to, you know, being insensitive towards urban minorities, because if some charter schools have propped up in urban depressed communities, not to mention, of course, the opposite, which is charter schools funding has destroyed the Detroit public school system, for example, and Eli Broud, who comes from there, has experimented, and all these billionaires are meddling in it, and they're putting in these so-called liberal politicians who are heavily funded in order to take over school boards to bring about charter schools, which by definition will destroy public education simply because they're going to take money away from them. So you can't, if you want to fix public education, the last way to fix it is to deny funds. But that's what they're doing.
Yeah, well, it's a very cynical narrative that they've peddled, which is that privatization is somehow being done on behalf of students of color. And the reality is, on the ground, these last year and a half of teacher strikes have exploded this myth, because you've seen both teachers of color and communities of color actively fighting against the privatizers and the charters. The Los Angeles strike is the most clear example, in which you have students walking out against the privatizing billionaires and in support of their teachers. So this idea that somehow being pro-charter is being anti-racist has been really discredited on the ground, but amongst a lot of the liberal commentariat who don't really care about strikes, I just don't think they've even been following the pretty massive sea change that has been spreading across the country. And the reality is, the demand for a moratorium on charters that Bernie correctly and really importantly raised, that was a demand that was raised by the NAACP. He was just reiterating a demand that was raised by one of the most important black organizations in the country. So it's definitely not the case that somehow there's a consensus amongst organizations of people of color to be in favor of charters. I mean, there's certainly some pro-corporate nonprofits and organizations that are benefiting off this, but it's not a consensus by any means.
So are you optimistic that working class issues will surface in this Democratic campaign, or will it be yet another example of identity politics, the coalition of identity politics, which is pretty much the direction the Democratic Party has taken since it's lost its ties or reduced its ties to organized labor?
Well, I think that we should be clear that some of what, you know, might be considered identity politics are working class issues. So if you think about immigrant rights, you know, these are talking about rights for a lot of working class people. But generally speaking, in response to your question, I do think that already we've seen an important political change insofar as the Democrats at least have to pay lip service to the types of economic material issues that, to be honest, in the past they mostly ignored. So just to give example again on charters, now across the board you actually have Democratic Party leaders, at least if they're not openly supporting them, for the most part have at least said that they're supporting public schools, and they're much more reluctant to come out for the type of pro-reform, quote-unquote, education changes that were peddled by the Obama administration. And the same on questions of Medicare for All and a lot of these other issues, in which at least the Democratic Party is being forced by Bernie and Warren to a certain extent to talk about some of the issues that most people care about. I'm very skeptical that anybody other than Bernie or Warren would actually try to implement these, but it does show that the candidates in these sorts of insurgent electoral politics and socialist politics has made a difference, and that they're forced to respond to us at the very least.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Blanc, the author of the brand new book just out, Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. I've been looking at some reviews of your book, Eric, and here's one. Red State Revolt is a brilliant, exhaustive look at the teacher strike wave. Every organizer should read it. So I'd say that's a good place to start. If Donald Trump wins re-election, my sense is that it will be the end of the Democratic Party, because the base of the Democratic Party is already, and I mentioned that anecdote about the town hall in Pennsylvania, the working class guy, you know, wondering why the party that traditionally supported him and his grandparents, et cetera, now seem to be consumed with social issues. That seems to have, that angst has arisen out of the loss of Hillary Clinton's to Donald Trump, who seems so beatable, and yet she lost to him. And that's obviously discouraged a lot of Democrats. But if whoever they choose just isn't the right person, and there's an awful big panoply menu of choices out there, and God knows how they're going to even manage to have debates with so many of the candidates, but still, I think if they lose in 2020, the rank and file will just desert them. So to my mind, there's a lot at stake here just for the future of American democracy itself. Since you're on the ground following these teacher strikes and other working class actions, and again, the idea that we all have to be political organizers or at least get active, at the grassroots, there's so much at stake. Do you sense the kind of concerns that I have, that the political left in this country simply cannot afford to lose in 2020?
Yeah, I think that the stakes of 2020 are extremely high, on multiple levels. One, as you mentioned, is just being able to defeat Trump. The horror of the Trump administration is not going to be easily defeated. I think, we shouldn't underestimate the traction that he's able to hold with a certain level of the population. And, one of the worrying dynamics is that the elite of the Democratic Party remains seemingly more committed to beating its own insurgent candidates than in beating Trump. So you could see a lot of divisions. You could see a lot of red baiting against Bernie and a sort of implosion on the left that would benefit Trump. So there's definitely a danger there. We're up against pretty powerful enemies on all sides. That being said, I'm relatively hopeful again, because as the strikes show, there really is a mass audience for working class politics when that alternative is being put forward, right? The reason we have had such a marked shift to the right for decades is really just because there hasn't been a political alternative put forward. And luckily this time, and this is why I'm relatively optimistic, Bernie, to his credit, on the national stage, is clearly putting forward this politics, and it can't be ignored. He's a front runner, after Biden, but we'll see. Biden's star could fade. So it's a game changer. There's somebody for the first time in generations talking about working class politics on a national stage, and I don't think that you can put that genie back in the bottle very easily.
Right, but there are polls and pundits saying that Bernie's star is fading. So what do you make of that?
Well, they've been saying Bernie's star is fading over and over for months, and they said the same in 2016. It's a little bit of wishful thinking on their part. The reality is that, first of all, polls this early in the game are somewhat ephemeral, and many things could happen. And that, I think, if you just look at the tens of thousands of people that are still coming out to these rallies and the base that I see as an organizer that's already cohering, it seems to me that there's a real serious battle plan. And who knows how it can play out.
So given that we've had these strikes, not just here in California, but West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, and a lot of red states, what's your sense of the role that teachers will play in this election? Are they going to be kind of magnets for organizing?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first thing to say is that teachers' unions are the strongest unions in the country by far. And now, particularly with the strikes, this is a sector of the working class that is the most organized, that is the most combative, and that has the potential of playing the type of role that in the past maybe auto workers played, or other sectors of the organized labor movement that were sort of able to be the pivot around which broader layers of working people could cohere to fight back against the billionaires. So yeah, the teachers are huge to this election, and that's why the stakes of what's going on right now in the teachers' unions is pretty high, where there's a major pushback from below amongst rank and file teachers and local leaders to prevent what happened in the 2016 campaign, which was that the top leadership of the unions did a early endorsement of Hillary Clinton. And this time there's a major effort organized in part by Bernie supporters to call for a democratic vote to let the members decide exactly who the presidential candidate to be endorsed of their union should be. And yeah, I think that teachers, by raising the stakes of the education issues on a national platform in relation to the presidential campaign, can be a really major player. And the fact is that Bernie was one of the only candidates, I think the only so far, who's come out with a major programmatic plan for refunding and saving public education. And it'll be interesting to see whether the other candidates now feel that pressure to come up with something similar.
But Eric Blanc, in your new book, Red State Revolt, A Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics, you document in the book that listeners might be surprised at how a lot of red state teacher strikes, like the one in West Virginia, involved the grassroots having to go against their own unions, because it's an assumption that progressive labor movements require the strengthening of unions, but unions don't always do everything in their power on behalf of labor movements. So is that at all related to unions often supporting Republicans against their members? Sometimes it happens, or it certainly happens with corporate-friendly Democrats.
Yeah, well, I think that the important distinction to make is between the union leadership and the union itself. One of the powerful rallying cries across these states and across these strikes was amongst rank and filers saying, we are the union. So it's not the decision of this relatively small group of officials, many of whom, to be honest, were pushed into supporting the strikes at best, and who were somewhat reluctant to do anything other than just lobbying the politicians as usual. And so the union really is what the rank and file make of it. And hopefully you can get the leaders on board. But sometimes and often, you know, these strikes were initiated from below and against a lot of opposition internally. And I think you're probably going to see a similar dynamic when it comes to the presidential campaign, where there's going to have to be a concerted push, because unfortunately a whole layer of labor leaders for a long time have gotten pretty comfy in their positions and have gotten used to a type of backroom dealing, particularly with the Democrats, that is just really out of step, I think, with the mood of the rank and file at this point.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Blanc, who is the author of the brand new book just out, Red State Revolt, A Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. And Eric's a former high school teacher in the Bay Area. He writes about labor movements past and present for The Guardian and The Nation. And just in wrapping up here, Eric, obviously it'd be great if the teachers in our audience picked up your book. Since you're a labor organizer and a journalist, how do you see the role? I mean, I asked you about the role of teachers in this 2020 elections, but this book would seem to me to be a pretty useful tool.
Yeah, the reception has been really great so far. It's been a mixed blessing for me on a personal level that there's been so many requests to speak, because I've been sort of traveling for the last 2 months already about the book, even before it came out, and I'm going to be on the road all summer and fall, because there really is, I think, a thirst to learn about what's going on, learn about these strikes. And to be honest, people need hope. And the strikes right now are one of the few rays of hope that we have, where people fought back and won. And I think understandably, particularly amongst teachers, but not just, there's a desire amongst people, progressives and some not so progressives, just to learn exactly how they did it, so that in the hope that we can replicate that, because they were able to win under pretty, you know, dire odds. And if they were able to do it in a place like Arizona or Oklahoma and win, then I think it raises the possibilities that no matter where you're at, you can fight back and win too. And I think that so the resonance and the support that the book has gotten, there's been a bunch of book study groups amongst teachers and other unions, reflects that, is that people are really looking for a way out of the impasse that we've been put into.
But the assault's happening on various fronts, particularly on the legal front, with Trump and McConnell putting all these Federalist Society right-wing judges on the courts. And, of course, there's a very important ruling about to come down over public employees' unions, which is designed literally to eviscerate public employee unions so that they can no longer collect dues. So that is, you know, I wouldn't hold my breath that the Supreme Court will do the right things and strengthen public employees' unions, because they're so damn partisan. They know that they fund the Democrats, so therefore let's just destroy them. That this five hard right guys, all of whom are extreme right wing Catholic Opus Dei types, at least the guy that put them there is an Opus Dei type, Leonard Leo. They're also into laissez faire capitalism as well as patriarchal attitudes towards women and being zealous anti abortion people. That's what we're up against in this country. I mean, in other words, you know, winning 2020 is absolutely necessary, but the greater task ahead is to change the Supreme Court, because their rulings last for decades.
Yeah, I think that's true. But the flip side is that one of the lessons we've learned from these red state strikes is that even if you don't have the right to organize, you don't have the right to strike, sometimes you can break the law and win if you have enough people on your side. So it's hard to imagine a legal context worse than Arizona, say. But nevertheless, they were able to organize successfully and win because working people have an amount of social power that isn't necessarily reliant on the law, that the ruling powers in these states realized at a certain point that if they were to resort to repression, because they could have, it actually would have backfired because the popular support for these strikes was so high. And so I think actually the lessons of these red state strikes is going to be important for the progressive movement as a whole to learn, which is that particularly in the face of what would appear to be for the foreseeable future, an extremely negative legal barrier to just a lot of our basic rights, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court on down, it's going to require a lot of mass movements to force these judiciary leaders to really cede to our demands. And I don't think we can rely on the courts, and there's going to have to be a lot of mass extra parliamentary, extra legal, and when necessary, illegal mass action to be able to force the politicians to listen to us. And there's a long history of that in this country, whether it's the labor movement was founded well before there was legal rights to organize, same with the civil rights movement. So I think we might have to return to that type of action if we're going to win in the new context.
Well, Eric Blanc, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks. It was great being on.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Blanc, who's a former high school teacher in the Bay Area who writes on labor movements past and present for The Guardian and The Nation, and is the author of the new book just out, Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with the man she loved. The head.